6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, independent speculative researchers. Good morning to you people. Thank you for out there for doing the big work, sheeple. It's 6 past the hour. Wake it up. Good morning. Mark Riley is back from a long day of judging, of taking someone else's life. Did you do any of that?
No.
Nothing. Sat there?
I read a lot.
Now what happens? I have not avoided jury duty, but I've been called and not been able to serve. I'm looking forward to serving when my time comes, but I have not been engaged in doing it.
We keep talking about it, your time will come soon.
Yeah, I'd rather that than an IRS investigation. It's so funny, how many people, it's just so funny about this network sometimes. It's that some people on this network are sort of like, the right never, oh, I'm giving it away. They never, ever question my integrity. They never, I could set myself on fire right here and not get on the Drudge Report. But anyways, not that I want to. I'm sure that would actually make it. Air America Morning Host sets it. Self-immolate.
On fire. Yes, that would make it.
Self-immolate in protest of no one paying attention to him. Wow, there's a political statement. Man, if narcissism were a political movement, I would be at the top of the pack, boy, with my sign, How Am I Doing? Ed Koch ran for years on that, didn't he?
He won for years.
There you go. I'm going to run for mayor of New York. How would that be? Tell me about jury duty. What's the process? How did it feel to be part of doing your civic duty?
Well, first of all, it is interminably boring. But what happens is you go into a very large room. There's about 100 some odd people sitting in the room. First, you process. You go through. You make sure it's your thing. They scan everything. They give you a thing to wear. They bring you in. They give you a whole thing about you, the juror. What a wonderful person you are for taking time out of your busy schedule to do this. I met a Morning Sedition fan. I want to say a special good morning to her. I don't know if she's up. I don't know her name. But she tapped me on the back when I was sitting there and said, You're Mark Riley? I listen to Morning Sedition every morning. You and Mark Maron are great. I want to thank you for the work you're doing. I mean, she was just effusive.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, that was really nice.
Very nice.
Yeah, some love for Morning Sedition. Otherwise, I read the New York Times, the Newark Star-Ledger, the Bergen Record, and the Daily News from cover to cover.
Which you do every day anyway.
Well, yeah. Because we work so early, I don't usually get the hard copies anymore until after we get out of here.
That's right.
So now it was like, I can sit back and leisurely read. I read, what was it, Dear Abby? I read everything.
Yeah.
Because there's really nothing else to do until they call you. So the first group of people that they read off, it's like 32 people for one case.
Uh-huh.
So they call my name.
Mm-hmm.
So that means I got to follow, through this labyrinth in the courthouse till we get down to this guy's courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
The 32 of us sit there, and they have to choose, because it's a civil case, they have to choose six regular jurors and one alternate.
Okay.
So they go through the list, and it's what's fascinating about this, Marin, is the kind of questions that a judge is required to ask of each potential juror, because this was a case that involved a fire and liability for the fire. So he had to ask whether anybody had ever been a firefighter before or anybody in their family had been firefighters. They asked what TV you watch and what radio you listen to.
Has anyone here ever set fire or something to get the insurance money?
Yes.
Anybody?
Well, since you were talking about self-immolation.
Has anyone set fire to themselves either on purpose or by accident?
Yeah. And it's interesting because there was one woman who I think in days gone by would never have been in the jury pool in the first place. She was a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
She was a corporate lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Very well-educated woman, first one gone. Because, the plaintiff and the defendant's attorneys can each use peremptory challenges. I don't know how many they can get away with, but, each one gets to say, okay, I want to excuse juror number whatever, and they don't have to give a reason. There's no particular thing about it. So they got rid of her. They got rid of another guy that went to MIT, but they never got to my name, knock wood.
Oh, so they didn't even get to your name to ask you what radio station you listen to.
Because
wouldn't you have to say, I'm on the radio.
Hey, I'm on Air America.
I have somewhat of an idea of how juries work because I've seen Runaway Jury with Gene Hackman. And,
that's
man, Well, it was a great film.
Well, 12 Angry Men was a great film. The original 12 Angry Men.
That's a genius film, and it's a play. I think it probably started as a play.
Yeah,
I would imagine.
Yeah, it did start as a play.
And that's back on Broadway now. I'd like to see it. By the time I get around to seeing a lot of Broadway plays, the big original cast has already gone.
It's already gone, yeah.
And, you know, it's just you know, the second stringers, which aren't necessarily bad, but usually I miss the big stars. But in that, boy, in Runaway Jury, that was ridiculous. That's one of those movies where you're sort of like, this is ridiculous. It's like, what was that other Dustin Hoffman? Dustin Hoffman movie where he plays the current outbreak, where he's actually able, you know, the nation, they're ready to blow up a town because of this outbreak, but he's able to find the monkey in the woods of California. You know,
yeah,
the entire world is at risk, and it's like, we've got the monkey. It doesn't jive with reality. Why am I talking about this? You know what the big problem is, Riley?
Tell me.
I'm cranky, man. I stayed up too late yesterday. I went to a special meeting. Rachel Maddow and I and Al Franken showed up at a meeting to meet with some of the people who are the new executives here, and
yes,
some of these potential advertising people. It was one of those inside the Air America Radio world kind of meetings.
Rah, rah, boomba.
Yeah, a little of that. Yeah. A little smooth. And me and but Rachel and I got to go into the MetLife building, which is by far one of the greatest buildings in New York City.
The one that's not far.
On 23rd Street.
Yeah,
I've always been fascinated with that building. It's a deco masterpiece, but
yes,
I've never been inside it. In MetLife, obviously, it's built on insurance money. It's built on, you know, getting people worried and, you know, and taking people's money out of the outside. Yeah, insurance companies are not the greatest people in the world, but let me tell you something. I think Stuyvesant Town was actually built,
yes,
to house MetLife employees.
Yes.
Because it's only a couple blocks
away.
Although,
not their black MetLife employees.
Right.
Not back then.
Well, you walk into this place, and the marble, I've never seen marble on the walls and on the floors and on the ceilings like this everywhere. You feel like you're in a mausoleum, but it's,
yeah,
a little more upbeat than that.
Gigantically high ceiling, too, right?
Huge ceiling.
Yeah.
All the deco fixtures are still in place. I mean, if you're visiting New York, I would suggest just to go into the lobby to see this amazing deco architecture. I was blown away. And Rachel, of course, had been up for like 23 hours, so she was half tripping.
It was kind of lost on her. Huh?
Yeah, and we go into this office, into this conference room with some of the execs, and Rachel and I are sitting there talking about Air America, and then, you know, in walks Al. Hi, yeah, how you doing? Yeah. And he sits down, and it's all of a sudden the world of Al. We're all rotating around Al. Look at us. We're just planets moving around the Al Franken sun. And, you know, I made the mistake of, there was a couple of times where, you know, you just want to sort of be funny and keep things going. But, you know, Al's got a pitch. You know what I mean? Al's,
yeah,
got an angle. He's got a presentation he gives about himself, about Air America. I hadn't heard it before. And then I didn't quite realize that it was sort of a set thing he was going for. So I'm throwing jokes in here and there. You know, in the first one, what did I say? I was talking about our show, and I was talking about how thrilled I was the first day we got some hate mail.
Mm.
Because it was hate mail that said, you know, you guys suck. I listen to you every day. You know, and that means, because I was told by a producer that if we're getting those kind of letters, that means a lot of people are listening. If those people are listening, then you got a lot more people are listening who don't feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
So my basic pitch was, because I think a lot of the concern around advertising is this going to alienate, is Air America going to alienate advertisers? And of course it isn't, because we're providing a different point of view, and we have an entertaining, funny show.
Yes.
So that's always been my angle. So you got haters, you got lovers, you got people, for whatever reason they're listening to, whether it's for information, whether it's for comedy, or whether it's a hate buzz, who cares? They're listening.
We love them all.
Exactly. So, Franken's telling this story. This, like, you know, he's going the other angle. He's like, you know, I don't know. People in this country love me. People come up to me and they tell me how much they love me every day. And it's very touching. I got a letter from a guy who was in the armed forces. And, he told me he didn't like me at first, and then he listened to me a little longer, and now, you know, he says he loved me.
Wow.
Well, yeah. You know. So, anyway, so he goes on and on, and, like, it's this long piece about how this guy has turned around and likes him, and then there's a P.S. that says, I hate you, Al. And I got a good laugh, and Al was like, nah. So he starts going on again, and then he starts talking about, I did this a second time, and then I really felt that there was some ire there, because he started going about,
you stepped over the line, didn't you, Barry?
I do that.
You drew outside the line.
I irritate people sometimes, Riley. Well,
that's what people do.
I irritate them. I can tell it, too.
You're the burr in the saddle, like they used to say back then.
You know why? Because I don't have the respect I'm supposed to. You know, some people walk through this world. I'm not talking about Al Franken. But there are some adults and some not-so-adults that walk through this world thinking that they deserve respect for what? You know, I don't necessarily think that I deserve any respect for anything. But there are people out there that think that they just deserve respect because they are who they are.
And Wait a minute. Don't talk about George Bush like that.
He's one. He's a great example. And I just can't stand that attitude. And Al doesn't have that. Al, I believe, is a very funny guy. He's a very human guy. He's a very passionate guy.
Is he a humble guy?
I don't know about that necessarily, but I mean, he's funny and he always interjects, so I think, you know, we're going to have a little go back and forth, and I can make Al laugh. There's no doubt about that. And
I've seen you do it.
Yeah, there was another moment that was just genius. Not on my part, but just because it was him and I'd love to do a comedy thing with him. Here's what he's doing. He's like, Rush Limbaugh presenting some numbers, and they weren't right. Yeah, you know, because you know why? Because he gets his information out of his butt. I don't know if I'm doing the impression.
Right. you're doing good. Right,
So Al goes, we checked the numbers, and they weren't right, because we tell the truth. And Rush Limbaugh gets his information out of his butt. Yeah. So I said, in his defense, Al, he's got two researchers up there. It got a big laugh, but I was like, man, we should do a show together. But, you know, I noticed that it wasn't like, you know, we should do a show together, ha-ha. It was like, all right, shut up. Shut up now. You done your little thing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So let's come back. We'll talk about Scott McClellan and his... God, that guy is so irritating. He's one of those guys
who I have
no respect for right when he starts talking, right when the tone of his voice, and now he's everything is Newsweek's fault. World War II is Newsweek's fault, apparently. We'll talk about that when we come back. 17 past the hour.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
You passed the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. You're listening to us.
Yes.
Good morning. If you want to podcast Morning Sedition, take the show with you every day, everywhere you go. Go to morningsedition.com for details. How about that? Do that. Email us at sedition@airamericaradio.com. On the break, we got a call from a woman who's like, "What? The Republicans are all together. They are all one front. They don't argue with each other. We don't even like each other. That's what's great about being a liberal, progressive person is we can all bicker and fight over little things."
That's right.
It's the beauty of the diversity of the big umbrella. Do you know what I'm saying?
Not only that, Republicans are all together thing is a load.
Of course it's a load. Look at what's going on, you know, in the Senate. Look at what's going on in the friction between, you know, neocons and conservatives, between fiscal conservatives and social conservatives.
And
moralizing idiots. Look at what's going. The thing is that the only way they're together is because there's a lot of, Manchurian candidate robots, creepers, whatever you want to call them, who are just easily programmed by Republican talking points and who are so narrow-minded and simple in their view that they seem like they're all together, but they're really just robots. And for the most part, narrow-minded and stupid. The way you can find one is that if you make any sort of positive statement encouraging democracy and any statement against Bush or against policy that this administration is putting out there, here's how you can tell if you're talking to one of the robots. Anything you say, like if you say that George Bush is bad for America, they'll go, but Clinton, and anything that starts with that, but Clinton, anytime you hear that, but Clinton, anytime you hear that, you're talking to a robot. You're talking to a narrow-minded, talking point robot. That's all I got to say about that. So let's move on into this. Newsweek is being blamed for everything by the Bush administration. And you know what? You know how I know this isn't true? Because even if I am, you know, and I'm no genius, that's for sure. I'm barely, historically, I don't have a great sense of a lot of things, but I was able to call this Afghanistan thing when with that Mohammed, with the Mullah Omar.
Yeah.
The Mullah Omar, when he refused the amnesty and said that that they're standing strong, that they're still going to fight, that was Monday. That was before this all this hit the fan, before you know, 3 days before these protests even broke out. I said, there's something going on there. And what's going on there is there's straddling a lot of these different groups, warlords, you know, Taliban, whatever's left. There's a percolating of civil unrest that even General Richard Myers said was sort of like, this was what democracy looks like when it's just starting out sometimes. And
yeah,
that means civil war when these guys say that.
Well, you know, they made Myers look like a complete fool. All right. Scott McClellan. Yes, folks. Scott McClellan made the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff either to be a fool or a liar. Myers said last week that these protests were not directly connected to Newsweek. And then what does Scott McClellan do?
Mm-hmm.
He goes on a 48-hour tear contradicting what the chair of the Joint Chiefs actually said. And see, the other side of this is, Mark, and this is the part that you're not going to hear a lot of people talk about. Well, 17 people were killed, and the blood of those people are on Newsweek. Okay, let's find out how they died and who killed them.
Mm-hmm.
All right? It was, in fact, the security forces and the military of the regime that we back in Afghanistan that killed these people. These people didn't have arms. If they had arms, you might have seen them try and take territory. You might have seen them try to do anything that, in other words, to go beyond simple street pro. Yeah, they were throwing rocks. Yeah, they were throwing probably stuff that was at their disposal. But when you read news stories that make it sound as if these people were armed and were killed in armed clashes with security, that's a lie. The fact is, in the bulk of these situations, at least from the way they're being reported, it was the military that shot the protesters, not the other way around. I didn't hear about any military people getting killed here.
Yeah, and the bottom line is complaints from released inmates that the Quran had been thrown into a toilet. They go back at least 2 years.
I mean, allegations.
Yeah, this stuff has been out in the ether for 2 years. I have no doubt that it happened. I mean, you know, think about it. If they're torturing people using fake menstrual blood that they're rubbing on guys' skins to make them go crazy because of their religious beliefs, you don't think they would have started with, you know, maybe throwing the book around a little bit? I mean, it's pretty clear that this stuff happened. It was the way that it was reported and the sourcing of the report that they have issue with. But the bottom line is, this is not what caused the unrest in the Muslim world. This is another example of the neocon death cult dispersing blame and actually blaming a magazine for their bad foreign policy decisions. And we can hear Scott McClellan defend this when we come back in that special Scott McClellan irritating, get under your skin, make me hate you way. 27 past the hour. We also got a couple of interesting things coming up. We got some interesting guests to talk about counterterrorism and also about the Saudis possibly blowing up their own oil fields when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. This is the prelude to the yoke. The yoke of the story. This is the story. We're getting around it. It was interesting on the break. We were talking about eggs.
Yes.
And Riley says he doesn't like egg whites that much. He just sees them as the prelude to the yoke.
There you go.
And I thought that would be a great record title. The prelude to the yoke.
Hit me.
All right. So we're talking about this Newsweek story and the reason that Newsweek was responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus.
Yeah.
But they're blaming Newsweek for everything. This is the neocon death cult's blame dispersal policy. Donald Rumsfeld should be out of a job. George W. Bush, theoretically, should be out of a job. To some people, is out of a job. Stephen Cambone, the Undersecretary of Defense, who is in charge of some stuff, should be out of a job. All these people should have been tracked up. Lindy England should have been the tip of the iceberg. That whole group there should have been gone through. Sanchez, it should have gone right up to Rumsfeld, and they should all be out of work, but they don't. They put people on ice. They blame disperse. They move things around. And now, clearly, Karl Rove, who I think may be gay, which isn't a problem, But I wish he just, you know, admitted that that's why James Gannon was in the White House press room all the time, is because he was just there after he did some other business. But anyways, those are my theories, and there's no reason to name call. But I believe...
Whoa. What do you mean there's no reason to name call? Go ahead.
All right.
Call some names.
All right, I'm just going to say there might be gay Karl Rove. And again, I have nothing against gay people, and I'm not judging him. I just think it would help everybody if he would come out and tell us why Jim Guckert was there. Why? But that is really another story. The story I want to get out is that Karl Rove is clearly responsible for this trick, this idea to blame Newsweek. Now, if you could, Riley, just quickly, because we talked about it before we came on, I'm not sure I understand the nuances, because McClellan is not saying that this is not true.
No, he's not saying that it's not true. What Newsweek actually retracted, Mark, was not the allegations of the Quran being flushed down the toilet. There have been 7 previous stories in the year, in the 3 years since the first incident, which, by the way, provoked a hunger strike that has been verified. Okay?
Right.
That was in March 2002.
Okay.
All right. 7 different times there have been newspaper reports about this very same thing.
Right.
So that's not what they were objecting to. What they were objecting to was Newsweek's assertion that a source told them that the Quran flushing incident was going to be in a military report about the way detainees were treated both at Abu Ghraib and at the Bagram prison inside Afghanistan. That's what they now say. The source has backed off the assertion that it's actually going to be in a report.
Okay, so probably, most likely, 98% chance that these are true events. 3 Britons who were released from Guantanamo in the summer of 2004 said that guards, quote, would kick the Quran, throw it in the toilet, and generally disrespect it, unquote. Last month, a former American interrogator confirmed to the New York Times a detainee story of mishandling of the Quran, once leading to a major hunger strike, as Riley just said. Eric Saar, who's on our show.
Yes.
Who is an Arabic language translator at Guantanamo from January to June 2003. And was on our Morning Sedition a few weeks ago, said there was no regular policy regarding the handling of the Quran, and that the issue, quote, created friction and problems all the time. And I want to say that before I cap this off with the yoke, that we had Noah Feldman on our show 2 days ago.
Yes.
Okay? We had Noah Feldman on our show 2 days ago speculating on whether or not the Newsweek article actually had anything to do with the protests going on in Afghanistan and Pakistan and throughout the Muslim world right now. And this is from that. Do you think that these protests that are spreading throughout the Islamic world, they can't just be a reaction to this Newsweek article? Don't you think they were triggered and organized on a different level?
No doubt about it. In Afghanistan, you've got a lot of people in the regions, basically warlords, sad to say our allies, who do not want to give up on their control of the country. And our guy, Hamid Karzai, who's the president, would like to limit their control. These guys are using this as an excuse to organize protests that will weaken his government, and it's worked.
Right.
And they would have found another excuse if it hadn't been this one, which does not mean that we should be a lot more careful about the kinds of stuff we do in interrogations.
But it just seemed to me that last week, or I think it was a week ago today, they offered Mullah Omar Mohammed an amnesty deal. He refused and said, we're still fighting. And then 3 days later, the protests break out.
Not a coincidence.
Right.
And the truth is that these guys are still fighting, and there's a connection in that sense, if only in that sense, between Afghanistan and Iraq. On both sides, you've got a lot of people who don't think they were beaten.
That was Noah Feldman a couple of days ago on our show. He's a professor of law at NYU Law School. He's also one of the authors of Iraq's preliminary constitution. What I want to say here is this. Newsweek has taken responsibility for the article, but the Bush administration has not, for prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. And this is what the real revelation should be, is this administration, if you think they're tough, if you think they're honest, you think they have integrity as Americans, are liars, and they refuse to take responsibility for anything. And that really on an emotional level, that would be a children's tactics, but on this level, it's insidious and evil because they know just how to play people's heads to where things just sort of disappear or the blame gets completely shifted and reframed.
Well, I mean, now Keith Olbermann did a really interesting blog that talks about the following. And by the way, this is a recurring theme with this administration. You have Scott McClellan, the same Scott McClellan who cleared Guckert Gannon into the White House press corps, the same Scott McClellan who called on this guy how many times, lecturing Newsweek about journalistic integrity. lecturing a magazine. I have no particular truck with Newsweek. I don't love him. Don't hate him. Michael Isikoff, who's taken a lot of the heat for this, was Linda Tripp's favorite reporter. Remember the role he played in the Clinton impeachment scandals, folks?
So you're saying not a liberal sympathizer?
No, he's no liberal sympathizer. He's no Dan Rather. The bottom nice word.
Sorry.
The bottom line is we're looking at an administration that will use anything at its disposal to avert responsibility resting on their shoulders, to avert the gaze of the American people on what it is they are actually doing. Somebody mentioned the other day, Mark, the idea that these are people who will talk about capital punishment, who will talk about the death penalty, and about the fact that government can use this ultimate sanction, but it is the same government who lied to us about Iraq, lied to us about so many other things, but they don't want anybody to think that there could ever be a mistake made in terms of executing the wrong person. The same government.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very true. And what Olbermann says is equally true. Scott McClellan has no business lecturing anybody about journalistic anything. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way in the world. You got to explain Gannon better than that in order for me to trust that you got some credentials to tell anybody about journalism.
Yeah, there's a strange McClellan, Rove, Gannon, Guckert sex parties going on right next to where they keep Bin Laden in the basement of the White House. There's a sex room. Anyways, let's hear Scott McClellan from yesterday, shall we?
Well, with respect, who made you the editor of Newsweek? Do you think it's appropriate for you at that podium, speaking with the authority of the President of the United States, to tell an American magazine what they should print?
I'm not telling them. I'm saying that we would encourage them to help.
Pressuring them.
No, I'm saying we would encourage them. Pressure? Look, this report caused serious damage to the image of the
encourage
United States.
Encourage reorder.
Yes.
We would order them if we could.
Newsweek has said that they got it wrong. You know, I think Newsweek recognizes the responsibility they have. We appreciate the step that they took by retracting the story.
We would like Michael Isikoff to go to Afghanistan
and do all that they can to help repair the damage that has been done by this report. And that's all I'm saying. But no, you're absolutely right. It's not my position to get into telling people what they can and cannot report.
It's just to suggest it heavily with the momentum of the White House behind it. We are trying to repress the freedom of the press because clearly they are not a team player in this particular situation. So what McClellan is saying is that the Afghanis some clerics have put out a jihad notice, and they want the guys who are responsible for throwing the Quran in the toilet. So I think what McClellan is saying is that, look, can we negotiate? We'll give you Isikoff. We'll keep the guys, and maybe you can get some better journalism out of them over there.
Well, we cut out the part where he said, next question, Jeff.
Yeah.
I mean, this is really a White House that, to say, well, we didn't pressure, we just asked.
What kind of White
How
House does that?
How absurd is that?
Encourage. What kind of White
we
House does that?
We encouraged them. No, you didn't. You pressured them.
There's more to this thing. Can we hear it?
Are you saying they should write a story? Are you going that far? How else can Newsweek, satisfy you here?
Well, we would encourage them to continue working diligently to help repair the damage that has been done because of this report. I think Newsweek is going to be in the best position to determine how to achieve that. And there are ways that I pointed out that they can help repair the damage. One way is to point out what the policies and practices of our United States military are. Our United States military personnel go out of their way to make sure that the Holy Quran is treated with care.
To write a story about how great the American military is that what you're saying here?
Elizabeth, let me finish my sentence.
No,
I'm coming to your question, and you're not letting me have a chance to respond. But our military goes out of the way to handle the Quran with care and respect. There are policies and practices that are in place. This report was wrong. Newsweek itself stated that it was wrong. And so now I think it's incumbent incumbent upon Newsweek to do their part to help repair the damage. And they can do that through ways that they see best. And so that's all I'm saying is that we would encourage them to
become a propaganda outlet for the White House.
And I think that they recognize the importance of doing that.
They recognize the importance of threatening, what is our propaganda machine and our, our idea of blame dispersal.
But it's a clever thing they're doing, though. It's a really clever thing McClellan's doing. He knows that what Newsweek got wrong was whether or not this report was, or these allegations were contained in the report. He knows that.
Right. They never said that it was wrong. They retracted it because of the sourcing issue.
Of the sourcing issue. It did. They never said that the flushing the Koran down the toilet part was wrong. Yet McClellan goes before the country and says, well, Newsweek got it wrong. It got the story wrong.
Well, you know what kills me is Rove, and not, I don't know what McClellan really knows. This guy is a cipher. He's a living lie. But, you know, what Rove knows is that people who hate, people who do not want to do the research, which is most people, according to some polls, would like to just blame a magazine. They want to just blame Dan Rather. They want to blame the media. They like doing that. So if you throw that bone to a bunch of morons or a bunch of people that do not want to do their homework in any way, they're like, well, see, that damn Newsweek. That damn Newsweek, that's why we have terrorism. And, you know, and people believe that. Believe it.
And there are people who, quite frankly, don't have any use for the Koran, don't have any use for Muslims, and don't really care what American soldiers do to the Koran.
Yeah.
Not thinking what would happen if, God forbid, there were American captives who found people trying to flush the Bible down the toilet.
Yeah, and what's interesting is a lot of, you know, particular type of religious fanatic in this country, they barely care about the Bible. All they care about is, you know, is their hate and the power of their numbers. And it's interesting that a similar attack is going on by the Republicans on PBS. And Bill Moyers, in a reaction a few days ago, in talking about the necessity of a free press, said something, you know, beautiful and cutting and truthful. And we'll hear that because it relates directly to what is going on with the Newsweek situation. 47 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Fifty-one past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
This morning's edition on Air America Radio. Dan Passman, son of Lewis and Linda Passman, alone in the booth. Never a good sign.
Never.
It's so funny now that Larson's working up during the day.
Yeah.
Passman's like, it is mine. Finally, it is my turn. Look at me run the men in the studio. That's hilarious. How you doing, Dan? You okay in there? You can't do anything.
His tips, though, between the, you know, during the commercial break.
Yeah, they're good. Yeah.
We need to do this, but then we need to do this.
Yeah, what do you think if we do this over here? And we're just sort of going, sure, Dan,
sure,
okay.
Right.
And then when he goes out, like,
yeah, right, we're going
to
do that.
What to do. That's hilarious.
Hey, what does he say? Is he buzzing in your ear now?
He was buzzing in my ear.
Man.
Something about a sandwich.
We're like, done now.
Yeah,
that's a bacon and egg wrap.
Big discussion. So let's get right to this Moyers sound before we get too far into an egg discussion. Bill Moyers at the National Conference on Media Reform, in addressing, I mean, this guy is the guy. He's one of the most respected journalists ever. You know, he hosted now on PBS. He was responding to comments made by Richard Tomlinson, the new Republican stooge at PBS.
Yeah.
He's going to try to, you know, have Oscar the Grouch pull himself up by his bootstraps as an example to other garbage puppets. But here we go. This is Bill Moyers, you know, talking about primarily why the press is important, and this is a good reaction to Scott McClellan from the last segment.
But I should put my detractors on notice. They might just compel me out of the rocking chair and back into the anchor chair.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm down.
Who are they? I mean the people obsessed with control, using the government to threaten and intimidate. I mean the people who are hollowing out middle-class security even as they enlist the sons and daughters of the working class to make sure Ahmad Shalabi winds up controlling Iraq's oil. I mean the people who turn faith-based initiatives into Karl Rove's slush fund, who encourage the pious to look heavenward and pray so as not to see the long arm of privilege and power picking their pockets. I mean the people who squelch free speech in an effort to obliterate dissent and consolidate their orthodoxy into the official view of reality from which any deviation becomes unpatriotic heresy. That's who I mean. And if that's editorializing, so be it. A free press is one where it's okay to state the conclusion you're led to by the evidence.
There you go. Bill Moyers with some very powerful words that we'll probably be playing throughout the next year or so.
Well, you know who he's talking about, don't you?
Sure.
That bootlicking fool Tomlinson, who's in charge of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Right. Now, look, you know, apparently, though, what's interesting is we've got this Pew poll in front of us. Now, the filibuster, the Senate goes into action today. Isn't that right, Riley?
What? Oh, you mean on the yes.
This is the nominee. Is it the process of the vote starts today?
Well, Bill Frist, the Senate Majority Leader, said that he will begin to bring Priscilla Owens' name and Janice Rogers Brown's name before the full Senate for an up or down vote. That's been his end game from day one.
Well, here's the interesting thing: is that a Pew poll said today, basically, if I can extrapolate and generalize, is that most people don't care about, you know, what goes on with Tom DeLay, about which way the filibuster goes. Most people are detached from it. Most people, you know, we talk about this stuff all the time. Sometimes I have to muster up the energy to care in the right way because it doesn't affect my life, you know, this morning necessarily, or my pocketbook, or the way that, you know, I move through the world on a day-to-day basis. Then I get this DNC poll the other day to basically categorize, to list the top 10 things that are important to me. And they give you a choice of about, I guess it would be 10 things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of work on some level to sit there and make a list of what, you know, what ranks in importance. You know, is it Social Security? Is it the economy? Is it energy policy? Is it bankruptcy legislation? Is it, you know, reproductive freedom? It's I don't know all the time what is important to people. You know, obviously. And I'd like some people to call me and tell them what the, you know, what is the most important thing to you in your life at 866-303-2270 in relation to how politics affects your life. Because sometimes even on our show, I don't know who the hell we're talking to. We get random emails from people who are pissed off. We don't go into something enough or we go into something too much. Some people just want to hear comedy. They want to feel better about their show, their day. Some people like it when we talk about the economy because it helps them. It's all very fragmented.
Well, you know, a lot of times, Mark, people don't care about stuff until their ox gets gored.
Well, that's always been the idea.
Yeah, people won't care about Social Security until the day they send that letter and say your benefits have been cut by 40%. People won't care about the filibuster until one of their grandkids got to go before a judge who's going to put them away for 50 years.
Yeah, for adultery.
Yeah, I mean, that's when people start caring, is when it starts stepping on their feet specifically. Talk about some of those people who are living in towns where there are military bases closing. They didn't care about that about the military all that much until now.
866-303-2270. What do you care about?
I want the legal right to be me.
Call us at 866-303-2270. Morning's edition.
Six past the hour, morning's edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
Fair America Radio. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, independent speculative researchers. Good morning to you. 866-303-2270 is our number. We're talking to people about what they care about. It's interesting because this is one of those things that all the Republicans care about is control. That's all they care about, control and money. And one of the great things about the liberal umbrella, as they say, is the diversity of causes. It's also one of our shortcomings. It's one of our weak points, but it's also what makes us great. And even I just imagine that just by going through this phone bank right now, by taking the calls we have, we'll see some of that diversity. Howard, listening to 1190 WLIV in New York. How are you?
Hey, Howard.
Hey, guys. How are you this morning?
Very good.
I have to say, my concerns were different and diverse. I had concerns about women's rights issues. I had concerns about what we were doing in the military and things like that. But after being down in St. Louis and hearing people speak, I realized that really it's the media, and it's all about the media and media consolidation.
You were at the National Conference on Media Reform in St. Louis. You saw Bill Moyer speak?
I did.
Oh, wow. That must have been powerful. I think you're absolutely right, because without a free and relatively truthful media, how the hell is anybody going to know what's going on?
Exactly. And it really brought to home how much we don't get information from reliable sources, or how difficult it is to get that information, and how it's such an exercise. It used to be the ability to get that information used to be so much easier, whereas now people have to actively go out and get it, and most people aren't doing that.
You have to forage.
Right?
You have to do information foraging. But let me ask you a question. Don't you think, I don't know what they covered there, but it seems to me that a lot of information that was never out and available, that literally you had to go to the special libraries to see if the information had been released, is now available if you do the looking.
Well, a lot of it is available if you do the looking, but also a lot of it has been redacted or has been reclassified. I mean, that's what's happening with the George Bush White House. So much more information has either been taken away, whether it be George Bush's gubernatorial papers,
right.
Father's papers,
right.
Reagan's papers, the release of information. I mean, Ashcroft has had information released, and then he went ahead and redacted it, but we already saw information out there, so then we could compare what was redacted to what was actually released, and we saw that they were redacting the most idiotic things. And it just really goes to show that they seem to take a black pen and cross out things without any regard for whether or not the American people are going to be positively or negatively affected by getting that information.
Right, just as long as it doesn't land on them. It's the blame dispersal.
Yeah.
It's people. Thanks for your call. Appreciate
you know what's
it.
The saddest thing about
what?
Bill Moyer's speech, though?
What?
Here's a 70-year-old guy who should be enjoying his retirement, and people with any sense in this country have to sit there and say, one more year. We need one more year out of you. He's talking about getting up and getting out of retirement and coming back, and that would be a great thing. But it also points up the fact that we don't have that many Bill Moyers in the pipeline.
Well, that's right. Where are the Bill Moyers proteges? Where are the disciples? They're out there, but how do they get, how do you get that type of seniority? How do you get that type of integrity, that type of profile? How do you get the opportunity to put the information to build your reputation in this day and age? Those outlets aren't there for you as much anymore, certainly, unless you find a niche, unless you find a blog that, has some integrity, that has some, that's become popular because of its ability to disperse truth properly. The outlets just aren't there, and it's all fragmented. Mindy in Boston, what do you care about?
Hey, Mindy.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
I'm actually a native New Yorker, but I've been transplanted for most of my adult life.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks for taking my call. I listen to you every morning.
Oh, thank you.
I even can't bear to listen to NPR anymore because I have to listen to the other side. I just can't even stand to hear them.
Thank God for bias.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, but my problem is that I care about everything too much.
Oh, so you get a little overwhelmed?
I do.
And you get, tired?
No, I feel like I'm in a rage a lot of the time.
Mm.
And it's I read the Globe and the Times and I hear about, all this stuff, and I just write these editorials in my head. It's the hypocrisy, stupid.
Sure.
I don't understand. I mean,
do you ever write the editorials out, Mindy?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's a good exercise.
I'm on all these listservs, and, I get most of my information that I really believe.
Well, that's good.
On the Internet, but
It's very hard to compartmentalize with so much information coming at you and getting so overwhelmed and so angry. I feel that all the time. I get exhausted from my anger.
And you know what? It's like they're so transparent because I don't know. Like they're constantly projecting.
Yes.
The things that they all do. With this thing with Newsweek and how horrible and lives have been. Well, you people have been doing this for 3 years.
Right. Well, I'm glad that you're writing and taking some action and thinking about this stuff, Mindy. Thanks for listening to us. Yeah, I know exactly what she's saying, and I think a lot of people get exhausted. I think a lot of people, when they get overwhelmed with anger, obviously not Mindy because she's there diligently writing editorials that I don't know if she sends out or not, but they get exhausted, and it manifests itself as depression, and it's not depression. It's a natural reaction to being lied to being denied the truth, to feeling like you're not being represented.
Well, the other thing is that it causes some people, and I know this from my own personal experience, it causes people to disengage. It causes people to say, hey, man, I'm not being bothered with any of this. Let's go have a party.
Well, yeah, a lot of apathy is just an overwhelming. It's a paralysis.
Well, and the conservatives and the Republicans count on that.
Yeah,
they really did. Richard Nixon went to the bank on it.
Yeah. Kevin, listening to 1190 WLIB in Queens. How are you?
Hey, Kevin.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
Mark and Mark. Mark Riley. Yeah, I'm one of them. just to say, when the easiest victim of a war is what? The truth?
Yeah.
And it's not about being overwhelmed. It's the fact that most of us Americans, including myself, we've got the analysis, and those who clearly understand, we're just in a paralysis of not acting.
Mm.
These guys are obfuscating the truth. If what we care about and the DNC wants to know, don't poll us and give us a selection of choice. That's
yeah.
a real choice. What it is look at that Constitution and that Bill of Rights and defend it with your life.
Mm-hmm.
That's our issue. I think we can pontificate a lot about what's going on, but the fact is, this regime is terrible for America. There are people who call themselves middle class who are bottom fishing in this economy.
Yes.
And we watch our rights go down the tube. We're exhausted because we realize we're angry and we need to act. It seems we'd be in the streets every day just protesting. Does that mean it is a visible presence? But you're right. Howard had it right. The media and the destruction of the media through this. Oh, I don't
want to
go there.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kevin. You got it.
You hear the anger in his voice?
Yeah, of course
his
I hear the anger.
His voice quivering.
Yeah. Well, he's right about the middle class, is that these people that are defending this idea of ownership society, of being middle class, are really just, you know, they could be homeless tomorrow. It's a lie. It's a debt culture. And they don't realize or they don't want to accept that they are economically compromised, that all of this legislation that these Republicans are putting through, bankruptcy legislation, restricting victims' rights legislation, the ideas that they have for Social Security are going to come right down on the people that think they're winning right now.
Well, yeah, and they're going to find out that the ownership society they think they bought into is as locked up as some of those banks were right after the Depression started.
And what do people really care about? You were watching Regis and Kathy, you saw Chewbacca.
Now, ordinarily, folks, I have anything personal against Regis or what the...
Well, you're not home usually. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not home. I'm here.
I was doing jury duty
yesterday. I had no choice in what they were watching. So when the woman said, does anybody want to watch Regis? Yay! So we watched Regis.
Uh-huh.
And the first thing they do is a promo is Chewbacca in hair and makeup.
Yeah.
Yeah, and now this was not the actor that plays Chewbacca. This is not the actor that plays Chewbacca speaking English dressed up.
This was the actual Chewbacca.
This was the actual Chewbacca.
Well, I mean, I just Peter McDonald just said that there's an outside chance we might be able to get him in the studio because they are making the rounds for the movie.
For the movie, yeah.
So hopefully we can get Chewbacca and maybe engage him in a little conversation about what's important in this country. Stay on the phone. We'll take a couple more calls. It's 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Call us at 866.
Ha! That's awesome. Go on.
303.
Wow, yes. Yes, I love it.
2270.
Oh, yeah, drop the bomb. Drop it. There's not a dry eye in the house. Keep going.
That's 866-303-2270.
Okay, well, just so you know, it was good, but I was also being pretty generous.
This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
This morning's edition on Air America Radio. You know, Brendan P.W. McDonald, our producer in the booth, just told me that not one call about terrorism. Isn't that interesting? Not one call about terrorism. And what's ironic is that we have a guest, Timothy Naftali, who's going to be here in a second. He wrote Blind Spot, The Secret History of American Counterterrorism. He can tell us about, you know, whether or not we should be afraid, whether or not what's really going on, how long has it been going on, and what actions are being taken now and have been taken in the past that's evolved this counterterrorism culture within the military and the government and what have you, and whether or not it really is as much of a threat as some of us have been led to believe. For those of you who are just tuning in, in, hear a few highlights of what we already talked about on the program. It's time for Morning Sedition's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. A new poll shows Americans don't care about what's going on in Washington. The good news is that most people who are paying attention see right through the Republicans. The bad news is nobody's paying attention. A significant number of people thought the filibuster was a new extra cheese pizza from Little Caesars. Democrats seek new tough guy image. Poll last year showed that while Democrats equaled or surpassed Republicans in public approval in a number of policy areas, more Americans trusted President Bush to manage the war on terrorism competently. That's like a woman staying with an abusive husband because he protects her from everyone but himself. Not necessarily a joke, but poignant, and something I've spoke about before. A bipartisan group of senators works on a filibuster compromise. It's heartwarming. Democrats and Republicans working together to give in to extortion. Both sides are trying to work together to avoid a filibuster, which just proves even politicians themselves, no matter what party they represent, can't stand to listen to other politicians talk nonstop and will do whatever they can to avoid it. There are some more Morning Sedition Cliff Notes later in the show. Let's take a call from Jim, listening to WINZ in Florida. Good morning, Jim.
Hey, Jim.
Hey, guys. How you doing this morning?
Good. What's on your mind? What do you think is the most important issue?
Well, the thing is, I'm going with the other issues that you're talking about before, about the numbness of our society to do anything. I mean, the whole idea is we've watched for the last 3 years, and it's not even insidious.
Yeah.
The lies and everything right in front of our faces.
Yes.
We watch our own government not able, it seems like they're frozen to do anything.
Hmm.
So we wind up with this anger inside of us, without the ability to change anything, and it's just very frustrating.
But I mean, the idea is that most people, this government is certainly, you know, continuing to lie, continuing to not take responsibility for its actions, continuing to pass legislation that hurts people of poor people, and obviously the middle class is going to pay for this. And I think what we've been talking about here a little bit is eventually people will get so angry, so desperate, so compromised that either they'll, you know, just die, or they will get to, you know, they'll make a change.
I agree with that 100%, but it's taking so long for it to happen that I know myself, my blood pressure has gone up 20 points.
See, that's how they're trying to kill us, Jim. That's what they're trying to do. That's part of their plan. You know, they want everyone to adapt or die, and they're just expecting people like us who get angry at them to explode, spontaneously combust.
Jeez, I have to take those pills. I never thought I'd have to, but I take those blood pressure pills.
My blood pressure is usually low. I don't even.
Mine was too.
I don't even understand that. So should we take one more call? Okay, let's talk to Tom, listening in Washington D.C. on XM. I wish we were on the real radio there, but you got IMS, don't you?
Yes.
What's going on?
What
do you think's important, Tom?
Well, I'll tell you. First of all, good morning.
Good morning.
What I find important, and I'm very concerned about, are the rights of the minority in Congress being steamrolled over by the majority.
Oh, awful.
The framers of the Constitution were really concerned about that the majority rule, you know, protecting the rights of the minority.
Absolutely.
And seeing what we're seeing now, it's just kind of a steamroller effect that it's either our way or the highway.
Yeah, well, that's going to play out in the next couple of days here. We're certainly going to see, you know, who's talking the real stuff. And, you know, I hope to God that, you know, they allow the filibuster, because that is the only holdout we have in senatorial procedures. I understand exactly what he's saying.
But, you know, what Tom is saying is interesting for another reason. And it doesn't pertain to him specifically because he lives in the District of Columbia. He's in Washington, D.C. But in many other places across the country, the thing you have to be concerned about is your state legislature. They're the ones that draw the congressional district lines that balkanize the country state by state.
Yeah.
Republican safe districts, Democrat state districts.
Right.
And they're done that way on purpose. They satisfy the interests, quite frankly, of both parties. But when the Republicans are in a majority, you can bet that the state legislatures are going to make sure that they continue to draw these lines so that there are a majority Republican safe districts, even if they look like pretzels.
Right. So, you know, we're going to have this guest come in just a second, Timothy Naftali, who is the counterterrorism. So, oh, my God.
Whoa.
Are you serious?
Whoa.
I can't believe this. He was just on Regis yesterday.
Uh-oh.
And now he's here today, Chewbacca.
Yes.
This is what people care about. So we've got the. Thank you for coming to our show. We know you're making the rounds for the movie. We're a political network, and in terms of we try to talk about politics. So, do you have any reaction to the filibuster fight in the Senate? Well, I think that's how a lot of Americans are feeling.
Pretty articulate guy, isn't
he? Well, yeah, clearly he's seen the polling numbers. And, now, are you I don't know how political you are. Yeah. Okay. So it's do you
red state, huh?
Yes. Is now, let me ask you about the Afghanistan protest. I'm sure you're keeping up with that. It's clear to me that it wasn't Newsweek's fault. Do you believe that? Okay. Yeah, I think he speaks for everybody. So
yes.
So the movie opens this weekend? Is it?
Is it this weekend? Tonight? Tomorrow?
I guess that's tonight or tomorrow. Friday, I believe it opens.
Friday, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for joining us, Chewbacca.
Bye. Wow, that was English he spoke for a second.
I had no idea it was so political. You know, it's interesting when you see a celebrity and you're not really sure about where they stand or how they feel about things, but clearly very emotional, very emotional.
And very articulate.
Yeah, I just...
I understood everything.
Oh, I'm glad you did. As usual, I don't understand everything. Timothy Naftali, the author of Blind Spot, The Secret History of American Counterterrorism, will be with us to tell us where we're at on that front momentarily.
And we've got the War on Brains coming up soon here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Right now, we are pleased to have in our studio today Timothy Naftali, the author of Blind Spot, The Secret History of American Counterterrorism. He's associate professor at the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs. He was a terrorism consultant on counterterrorism to the 9/11 Commission. Good morning, Tim.
Morning, Mark.
Good morning.
I guess the big question that we should start out with and work back from is, where do we stand today? We hear a lot of reports that we're not as safe as we should be. A lot of the money that was supposed to be allocated to really take care of our airports, our ports, as nothing has been done or nothing has really changed in those areas. What do you know?
Well, I think the first thing you've got to keep in mind is Al-Qaeda hates us, and you'd think that if they could have hit us by now, they would have. It's amazing to me how our government comes up with a series of explanations time and again in order to make us feel more alarmed than I think we should be. We are in a very important struggle with a terrorist organization, but that doesn't mean that our civilization is imperiled.
Right.
Remember, I don't know if you remember the argument that, well, Al-Qaeda takes 3 years to plan, and therefore we should be afraid for 3 years. I was wondering if there was an egg timer somewhere in Afghanistan. When in fact, Al-Qaeda, when it hit us twice with the USS Cole and, of course, the planes operational, we know it's 9/11, those two plans were designed simultaneously. So if Al-Qaeda wanted... Well, it kind of wanted to hit us, but if it could have hit us, it would have hit us by now. So I suspect it is more disrupted and less of a threat, a potential threat, no, but less of a real threat today than it was a few years ago. That's not to say that we are being terribly successful everywhere. I think part of it is that Al-Qaeda didn't have the resources in this country. Why do you think it brought 20 people into this country to commit that atrocity on September 11th? Because it didn't have the sleepers in this country to achieve it. Actually, on the terrorism front, I'm quite optimistic. On the national front, I'm not very optimistic. I don't like the way in which we've dealt with terrorism as a people. I don't like the national conversation. I don't like the way in which the government has explained the threat to us. I think they've made it more alarming. than they need to have done.
Was that done for, I mean, my assumption has always been, and now Tom Ridge has come out and said that they were jacking up warnings, you know, when there was very little evidence of anything. My assumption was always that was propagandizing to keep people frightened and to maintain power on this behalf of this administration.
One of the arguments I make in this book is that we should be treated like adults, that Americans deserve to be treated like adults, and that there is a balance between security and liberty. I'm a civil libertarian by nature, but there are times when, in order to be a little more secure, we as a people have to deal with more checks, more security procedures at airports, for example. During the campaign, the 2004 campaign, the argument was made that we would be more secure if one party were elected over another, which I thought was an outrageous argument to make. We are more secure when our police and intelligence community gets better. That's when we're more secure, and it doesn't matter who the president is. Do I think some people raise the alarm bells in order to make political hay? Yes, of course.
Now, Tim, what is it? You said just now that the national conversation troubles you. What is it about the conversation that troubles you?
Mark, there is no conversation. That's what troubles me. There is none. On the Patriot Act, for example. You know, I discovered this as working on this book, that a number of the provisions in the Patriot Act that have been so controversial were actually proposed by the Clinton administration in 1995.
Which ones?
These are the ones about roving taps, about some endowing the FBI with additional powers to surveil us. Those were actually proposed in 1995 by the Clinton administration because of a sense that in order to do domestic counterterrorism activity, the FBI needed more powers. This is a long-standing debate in our country. It's not an easy one. Again, you know, I just want people to know the truth, the background to it. In the 1970s, for good reason, people were angry and upset at the abuses that the FBI had committed in the 60s. J. Edgar Hoover.
Can you name a few?
Well, sure. I mean, how many? Do we have an hour?
The most important ones to you.
The most important ones to me was the viewing the civil rights movement as a seditious, threatening movement with foreign links.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's completely wrong.
Hoover said that for a long time.
And, well, he was afraid because we do know that Martin Luther King, among his wide circle of advisors, Martin Luther King did have someone who had been a member of the Communist Party. But to make the argument that somehow Martin Luther King was a threat to, was some kind of stooge, is a different issue. But there are a number of people in the FBI, more importantly, actually, in state police organizations that were feeding the FBI, were making that argument. Anyway, in the 1970s, yeah, we reacted to that for good reason. But we threw the baby out with the bathwater. And made it a lot harder for the FBI to do really understandably legitimate counterterrorism investigations at home. We have this extreme mentality in this country. We go from one extreme to the other.
Yeah.
We don't like to sit in the middle for some reason. So we have these abuses, and then we shift to the other side. And the Clinton administration actually tried to bring us closer to the middle. I know, they committed a lot of mistakes, but they tried, and they failed. And they failed largely because of Newt Gingrich and the Republicans. It's one of the great ironies.
Yeah.
I can't believe this. The Republicans in the House were the ones who were against these, I consider, rather legitimate counterterrorism measures that the Clinton administration proposed in 1995. And now the Republicans present themselves as the great saviors of our security, when in fact, if the Republican House members had passed this in 1995, we would have been much safer on September 11th.
Well, they're certainly good at erasing history and revisionism.
Well, yes, it's amnesia.
Yeah.
Mm. Tim, we know certainly that the CIA cannot get involved in domestic intelligence. They built that firewall. So the responsibility has fallen to the FBI. CIA still does foreign stuff. How well do you think they've managed to coordinate their activities since September 11th, where they seem to have got a little bit more breathing room?
Well, here's the thing, you know, how well... They say that they do it better.
Mm.
Obviously, everybody
knows.
Yes,
we've been told that.
Yeah,
yes.
No, I mean, well, that's part of the talking point. This is astounding. You know, think about the outcome of this tragedy. I make the argument that we, when there's a surprise in American history, we generally call it an intelligence failure. We do that in order to shield our political leadership from responsibility. 9/11 was as much a policy failure as it was an intelligence failure. One of the things I do is I show how the shift from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration, the effect that shift had on our ability to monitor al-Qaeda. It is amazing how this priority, which, I mean, there's no question that Clinton felt he was at war with bin Laden after those two embassies in East Africa were bombed. So from the summer of 1998, secretly, he never told us, but secretly, that his administration was at war with al-Qaeda. Bush comes into power, and terrorism drops from being the number one or number two issue for the government to number five or six. Stem cell research, tax cutting, China, missile defense, all of them become more important. And so terrorism drops. Today, the FBI and the CIA are saying that that they are interacting very well. But of course they're saying that. I do think the establishment of a National Counterterrorism Center is a good thing. But our problem in American history, our problem is we create these institutions after we've been surprised, and then they get fossilized. I'm sure that no terrorists with box cutters are ever going to take over planes again in this country. But am I convinced that we have the kind of nimble intelligence community and policy-making community that can react to a morphing threat? Because after all, our enemies, and I'm not saying there are a lot of them, but there are determined people out there who would like to do us harm, they are trying to be ahead of us. They're trying to think about weaknesses in our system.
Well, isn't there all indication that global terrorism is increasing with the war in Iraq, and that, you know, what's going on in Afghanistan and Pakistan right now is a direct relationship to American policy, and that these are just breeding grounds again?
Mark, my part of my book began as an internal study that I was writing for the commission staff, 9/11 commission staff, on how our government has dealt with this and sort of the prehistory. This is before 1998. I mean, I did for them 68 to 93. No, and I had a chance to talk to anybody I wanted except for former American presidents. It was sort of the deal that we struck. I didn't meet a single counterterrorism specialist who thought Iraq was a good idea. Not a single one.
Yeah, we talk to them here sometimes.
Yeah. Let's put it out on there. It was a distraction from the main enemy. If anything, we have created a failed state in Iraq, which is a home now, a haven for more terrorists. I mean, what we have, and if you notice how our troops are spending so much time in Anbar province, which is the western province, which borders on Syria, that is like the northwest province between Pakistan and Afghanistan. It is now a haven for these kinds of terrorists.
Yep.
We've created a magnet for terrorists. It was a mistake. No question about it.
Quick question about the home front. We see when the government starts allocating money for counterterrorism activity, this kind of feeding frenzy with different jurisdictions, different politicians, this one should get this kind of money, the counterterrorism center should be located at Texas A&M. I mean, how do you get past the policy/political nonsense that goes on with
this? Oh, this is a great CYA story. Occasionally I teach history of counterintelligence, counterterrorism to mid-career professionals in the intelligence community. And this guy who is the number two in an FBI office in a second-tier American city. Actually, I can say which one. Pittsburgh. It's a nice city. I'm sorry. If anybody lives in Pittsburgh, I apologize. I didn't mean you're not second tier. You're number one. But anyway, I said, how many resources do you spend on counterterrorism in Pittsburgh? And he said to me, 70% of our work. I said, listen, Pittsburgh's a nice town, but 70%? Why? I mean, what have you got? Well, we've got Carnegie Mellon. I said, well, Carnegie Mellon is fine, you know, but come on. Why? It's not a major target. I can't imagine Osama bin Laden sitting in his cave saying, Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh. And he said, well, it's very simple. If there's a terrorist attack in Pittsburgh, and we haven't been spending 70% of our resources, a congressman or a senator from Pennsylvania is going to go to the FBI and say, why didn't you work on Pittsburgh?
Oh, yeah, Rick Santorum.
No, why didn't you work on Pennsylvania? Why didn't you put it up? So the point is, in order to protect ourselves, we do this. He said, I'm not suggesting you do this, but this is a great time to be in white-collar crime because the FBI does not have the resources. They're putting all these resources in counterterrorism in areas where the chance of a terrorist attack is so small as to be negligible. And that's our problem. Now, we are so afraid... Bureaucrats are so afraid of another surprise that they are investing resources in low-probability events.
Well, Timothy Naftali, thank you so much for being with us. The book is Blind Spot, The Secret History of American Counterterrorism. Very engaging. Nice talking to you.
Great talking to you, man.
Thanks very much, Mark and Mark.
And we'll be back with the War on Brains in just a second. It's 46 past the hour.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
One past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Good morning, sheeple, friends. Hey, I'm feeling a little better, buddy.
Why go to college? Why go to night school?
Exactly. I was a little cranky this morning. I feel better.
You feel better now, right?
I don't know why.
There you go.
Loosened up.
Somebody massage good. You or something?
Yeah, I mean,
you
what?
Had a little girl next door to
you? Who's that?
Massaging your back.
Oh, no. I wish they don't have that. They have those people on the street sometimes. Now.
Yeah.
You just walk by them with the chair. No, I don't know what it was. Maybe it was Chewbacca dropping by. Every week, we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the four-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milfington.
Dateline, Topeka, Kansas, the place where Reverend Charles Sheldon first asked that famous question, what would Jesus do? Which was quickly followed by the answer, probably not live in Topeka. Last week, we saw how the state formerly known as Bleeding Kansas, for its heroic stance against slavery, officially changed its name to Bleeding Idiot Kansas by taking steps to require creationism be taught in science classes, relegating evolution to an unproven theory. And now, like that state's mighty hunters of old, who exterminated the buffalo from the comfort of a railroad dining car so their descendants wouldn't have to, the Kansas Board of Education is about to deal the death blow we hoped would never come. For now, they want to redefine science itself. Creationists and other superstitious hawkers of hokum are pushing the board to change the accepted definition of science that limits it to empirical explanations for what happens in the natural world to a definition that includes spiritual crap.
Oh, yeah.
And some of their explanations for what happens in the natural world include God's anger against the Jews, God's anger against the Muslims, tree spirits, and, of course, God's anger against the Jews. Kansas, you've just suffered the worst farm accident in history. Your brain's been ripped out by a McCormick's Reaper and lies a-quivering near the chicken coop. And your ability to reason has been wished into the cornfield, where it will most likely die a lonely death among piles of annoying Twilight Zone scripts with overly clever ironic endings. Now, don't get me wrong, Kansas. Kansas hasn't always been this dumb. My German ancestors didn't settle in Barton County 130 years ago just so they could become Masons, eat grasshopper dust, and give Indians the clap. No, they endured the hardships of a free railroad land and living next door to the Irish to prosper as farmers. And you can't do that by rejecting science. It takes lots and lots of farm subsidies. And a good understanding of science, too. No self-respecting wheat grower is going to look at that dog-sized boll weevil gnawing on his wife's leg and not marvel at the way it turned from a normal grasshopper just 2 years ago into the pesticide-resistant, bone-crunching monster it is today. And they know that's all due to a little thing called poor land management. Oh, and natural selection. So how did Kansas, a place where 26% of its citizens have bachelor's degrees, well over the national average, how did America's 15th smartest state transform itself into a land full of Panglossian jackanapes? Evolution, I guess.
Yeah.
How's that for a cleverly ironic ending, Rod? I have a feeling we're not in reality anymore, Toto. And that's today's dispatch from
the War on Brains.
That was great, Mort. That was great. That was one of the funniest, most intuitive ones of the War on Brains reports.
Thank you, Mark.
So, you know, what else you got going today?
Well, there's not much happening, really.
Bow! You know what that means? There's breaking news.
That's
what's
right,
going
Mark.
On, Mort?
Well, it turns out they've got breaking news down in Lower Manhattan. Greenwich Village, the New York Parks Department, says it will abandon plans to put gates around Washington Square Park.
Oh, my God.
Whoa.
What are the... You got the five W's? The who, what, when, where, why? If you got them?
Let me go out and get the five W's.
You're going to go
you.
Out and get them for us?
I'll be
You're
right
gonna
back.
Go do some reporting? All right, we'll come back and we'll get right to the bottom of it.
Okay, Mark. I won't do you wrong.
Okay, buddy. Here comes Mort.
I won't do you wrong.
He's going to come
what,
back.
You've been listening to too much R&B music. Is that the idea?
I don't know what he listens to, Fed. There's several things that's going on. There's so many levels in the Mortensen head.
I know, man.
Not
but
to
he
mention
sounded,
that.
It sounded like you went Al Green there.
Yeah.
I won't do you wrong. I won't do you right.
Well, I just hope we get to the bottom of that story.
Yeah.
You know, we need good journalism here on the show in terms of actually getting people, reporters out there in the world. to get hey, if you want a podcast Morning's Edition, you can do it at morningsedition.com. There's some cats who've helped us out with that, and you know, a lot of people are doing that. I got to get the iPod. I think I got to get it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think I'm going to get it. Chris, I'm going to get it.
You got to get the iPod.
Where was the talk? You were going to give me your iPod. What happened to that? Why don't you give me your
That's
iPod?
That's out the window.
What happened to the free iPod?
I'm actually someone else here wanted to buy my iPod off me for like $200.
$200,
yeah.
Uh-oh.
So, you know, I don't know. I mull over all these, you know.
Who the hell wants to buy your iPod for $200?
Someone at the radio station.
That's it? That's all I get? What, are you hiding identities?
He's not telling you, man. Don't try and get it out of him.
Gerald, the engineer.
Oh, Gerald wants to buy it? All right. Well, if he wants to buy it, you know, I think you should just give it to Gerald. Where's your sense of charity? Remember we talked about charity yesterday? Nothing?
Hey, I do a lot of things. You know, I help people all the time on the subway.
All right. Well, maybe I'll give you... No, I'm not going to buy it. Sell it to Gerald if you want. You know what? I'm going to live without it. So Mort Mortensen's going to be back with the five W's, hopefully, after the break.
Yeah.
We got Gerald Posner to talk about the Saudis who apparently have their oil industry rigged to self-destruct if necessary.
And we're going to tell you a little bit about buying certain fuel at a certain gas station on Air America Radio. Blah, 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 blah.
6 past the hour. It's Morning's Edition here on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hiya.
Oh, my God, Riley. I feel a lot better than I did this morning. I don't know if it's Wednesdays or what. Do you ever get up on Wednesdays and just like it's the middle of the week? I don't. You know, maybe
yeah.
I'm whining. Should I whine? In a few minutes, we're going to tell people just why they should buy their gas at Cisco. And this is something you've been talking about for almost
a while.
It's a news break. It looks like Mort Milfington, I'm sorry, I get you and your brother confused, is back with the five W's.
That's right, Mark. I'm back from the story down in Greenwich Village, Washington Square Park.
That was quick, man. That was like 7 minutes. He went up and back already.
Down. You got a transporter beam or something? Controversy of putting gates around the park.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
How'd you get up and back so fast? Do you want to address that at all?
Subway, very fast.
Okay, good. What are the five W's, my
friend? Five W's. Who?
Yeah.
New York Parks Department.
Mm-hmm.
What? Gates around park.
Mm.
Where?
Mm.
Park in Greenwich Village. When?
Mm.
Today.
Mm.
Why? I don't know. What am I, Kreskin? I have three additional W's, Mark.
What might they be?
Wainscoting.
What?
No wainscoting is involved in this story.
Yeah. Okay.
Wart.
Yeah.
This looks like a wart to you.
Let me see.
Is that right?
Wilford Brimley. Cannot abide by him. Do not like the man. Those are the five W's plus three, Mark.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mark. That was some good reporting. You're an ace at this. Speaking of Wilford Brimley, where did you bring it up? Because I got sucked into watching Brubaker last night with Robert Redford. Are you familiar with that film?
Oh, yeah.
You remember that one? He plays a prison reformer in the Southern Prison. And Wilford Brimley is one of the guys on the board for the city. Do you remember that?
I do.
This is early Brimley. This is going back a bit. This is before the oatmeal commercials, before he played the heavy and the firm. I mean, this is vintage Brimley.
Before the diabetes?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Before the diabetes. And, you know, he still had that... He still had that mustache.
Mustache.
Did he have diabetes? Or was it...
He does a commercial for diabetes. Mm-hmm. I am Wilford Brimley.
Yeah.
And I have diabetes.
Wow.
And you can get your testing supplies sent free.
And if you're insured, I'll take care of it for you.
This is the first time I've seen Riley do an impression. I think that deserves a little something. Come on.
Thank you. I want to thank the little people.
I mean, Mort. Sorry.
And you too, Mort.
That's the best Chewbacca I've heard of seen. What was that? What was that?
You know, Mort, as a journalist, mm-hmm. I don't know if you know about this story, but union employees at Reuters they're stepping up their campaign against the wire service outsourcing of U.S. jobs. They're outsourcing Reuters employees. Yeah, they're outsourcing journalist jobs. Are you concerned about that? That perhaps now there might be a Mort Milfington somewhere in India or, say, China that might be doing you as well?
I'm a freelancer, Mark. I have no contract. I answer to no man.
Mm. Okay, well, that's good stuff.
Wait a minute. One of their outsourced reports says that Krakow is in Poland? I mean, in Portugal?
You would never make that kind of mistake, would you?
No, he would. No, I have researchers.
Now, do you think maybe you could go cover this? Maybe you should go abroad. Do you think maybe you could take a trip and maybe cover this story for us?
Fly out the five W's?
Yeah. Could you?
Sure.
We'll give you a week on this one. Please. We think.
Thanks. It'll take me that long to look up the W in the dictionary.
Yeah, and find an intelligent, interesting new W, and also cover the story about Reuters outsourcing their journalists.
I'll do that for you, Mark. I won't let you down.
Okay, thanks a lot,
nice
man.
Work.
So take care, Mort. We'll see. I guess your brother's going to be in on Monday, so we'll see him.
Right.
Do you guys all hang out together or what?
We hate each other. There's a feud.
Well, you know what? You know what I want to say right now to you? Thank you for playing along. That's what I want to say.
Ba-ba-ba!
Okay. See you later. Give me one. Give me.
Whoa, there you go.
Wait. Come back. I want one amalgamated. Come back. I want one amalgamated.
Worried about excessive bank fees? Worry no longer. We'll take your car and your home away.
Amalgamated Bank. Thank you. Thank you. See you later. It's funny that all you guys can do that. There he goes.
There he goes.
At least he didn't go with the Go Bananas number that he's been doing the last few days.
That's his brother.
Yeah. Oh, that's his brother?
Yeah, we get a lot of these guys confused. The Milfingtons and the Mortensons and what have you. So do you understand what exactly they are outsourcing from Reuters? It seems sort of strange to me that they would be able to outsource journalist jobs, but Reuters is a new service.
Yeah.
So how does this work, Riley?
Well, what they've done apparently is taking some of the editing and caption writing of photos they've been sending to an office in Singapore, and they've been doing some internet work in Toronto. Now, Mark, the interesting thing about this is Reuters at one time, prior to its current situation, had bureaus in these places where they actually had reporters going out and covering stories.
Right.
A Hong Kong bureau. All of the news services in this country have been systematically, over time, shutting down those foreign news bureaus. What they're doing now is outsourcing, I guess, what you would consider to be, in some instances, the grunt work. But you're talking about misidentifying Krakow as being in Portugal, saying that Lindy England was the commander of her unit rather than a private in her unit, these kinds of things. And my guess is that the Reuters employees are saying to themselves, well, the more of this work that can be done by somebody who's making one quarter of what someone in the States is making. Remember, Reuters headquarters is within spitting distance of here. It's not far. It's in Times Square.
Yeah.
So, and of course, that's a very expensive piece of real estate. They got to pay people, the prevailing living wage in New York. So they're doing what everybody else is doing. The irony of this is that, of course, it is journalists who have gone back and forth on the benefits or problems with outsourcing for the last several years anyway.
Okay.
Including, I'm sure, a bunch of Reuters journalists who never thought in a million years that any of their work would end up overseas.
Wow. There's so many things, there's so many nuances about economics that are beyond me, Riley.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond me. Is there a book? Should I get one of those beginner's books on economics? I need to learn more. Do you feel like tight on your economics?
I don't know. I don't know that much about economics, but I do know this, and I know this from talking to many, many people who've worked at for Wall Street firms, investment banking firms, and that sort of thing. You know which book that many companies require their incoming employees to read?
What?
That book, The Art of War.
Yeah, I know that.
Yeah, the whole thing about, you know, killing 5 zillion people to get one day. That's apparently the mentality that's going on down. Anything more complicated than that, I'm not sure they buy into.
Yeah, that and cooking the books. You know, I that's what concerns me the most is that, you know, we even with our little show, you start to see how corporate mentality works in terms of somebody, you know, like even like Donald Rumsfeld. Like, there's going to be a lot of resistance to these base closings, and rightfully so.
Yes.
It's going to crush, you know, state economies. It's going to crush local communities. It's going to actually, they say, you know, hurt recruiting potential and not, you know, it's going to also hurt their ability to hold on to National Guardsmen and some of these people that are not in the permanent army. And yet, no matter how many people stand up and scream, like even our show, you know, in San Francisco that was moved in the middle of the night, there's a petition going on to get us back into our time slot from 6 to 9. But, like, you know, Clear Channel is a corporate entity that behaves in a certain way. You know, the government is a corporate entity that behaves a certain way. And they don't have to, you know, theoretically, the government has to answer to people. But they think that, like, eventually the people will quiet down and that they'll go away and in the future they'll thank us.
Well, see, here's the thing with Donald Rumsfeld that people are starting, and people, I think, ought to have expected this to happen sooner or later. People are looking at Rumsfeld, and Rumsfeld is saying, well, you know, we went through all this exhaustive research to decide which bases to close. You know, we did all these 5 zillion permutations and all the rest of this, and we know that these are the bases we need to close because all this research we did says so.
Right.
All the research they did on Iraq said they had weapons of mass destruction, didn't it?
Yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with research. I just think that people...
Of course it doesn't. What he's doing is shamming.
Right.
What he's doing is saying to the American people, trust me, even though I lied to you before, trust me now.
And the thing is that people get upset. This is the whole thing that our guest, Jim Natale, was talking about,
Tim,
is that the sense that, you know, people will be outraged at first, they'll demand the truth, they'll get overwhelmed or angry or paralyzed or apathetic, they'll get depressed, and eventually they'll tire out and no longer protest or no longer speak out for what they believe in or get used to whatever is in its place. You know, it's very hard to stay diligent and to stay on top of this stuff and to stay, you know, fighting. You know, these Republicans certainly did it. For 30 years they put this whole culture shift into place.
Oh, yeah. But the thing with guys like Rumsfeld is that they count on the fact that people will forget, people will get tired, people will say, to hell with it. And that will be the opening through which they do the nonsense that they do.
It's frustrating. We're going to be back, and you're going to tell us why we need to buy gas at a certain place. Right, Riley?
Yeah.
All right, 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Mark Maron's mom, and you're listening to my son and his friend, Mark Riley. They're very good boys. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey,
it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Good morning, folks. So, Riley, you've been talking about this for a while.
Yep.
Why and where do we need to buy our gas?
All right, I have been for the last little while buying my gas from Citgo. Why have I been buying my gas from Citgo? Because I, unlike Condoleezza Rice and the entire Bush administration, admire the work of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Now, what does Citgo have to do with Hugo?
Yeah, let me ask. What does Citgo have to do with Hugo Chavez, Mark?
All right. Citgo's 14,000 gas stations in the United States pump their gas at the behest of Venezuela's state-run oil company.
Mm-hmm.
So that the profits from that state-run oil company go to the government. Hugo Chavez has used those profits to try and better the lot of the poorest people in the slums and in the farm country of Venezuela. In other words, this huge oil windfall, which, by the way, has been part of the reason why the United States has found it so difficult to dislodge him after they tried that coup attempt a few years ago, and then the referendum that put him back in, or that kept him in office 58% to 42%.
And isn't it sort of a similar situation that got Allende killed by Nixon over copper?
Yeah, exactly. Precisely.
Okay.
Well, what's going on now is that, and now some people say, well, you're just not buying from the Saudis. I don't, you know, my thing is not necessarily to quibble with the Saudis. They're not my favorite government necessarily.
We'll have Gerald Posner do that coming up shortly.
Shortly, yeah. But I do like the idea that a little bit of my money is going to help the poorest people in Venezuela.
Yes.
Now, a lot of people will try and dodge around that. I read a piece in The Economist the other day that, you know, said that Hugo Chavez was a boogeyman and, you know, he's doing this and he's doing that and he's doing the other. He's scared to death that the United States is prepared to invade because he believes, and I'm not sure he's wrong about this, that the U.S. was a little bit behind that coup attempt. They announced it actually before it supposedly happened.
Wait, the U.S. behind a coup in South America?
Oh, no.
How crazy is that?
Perish the thought. But to me, and you know, not everyone may look at it this way, but to me, this is my little way of saying, Hugo, I'm down with you.
Let's take a call. We've got a guy calling from Los Angeles listening to us on KTLK out there. Michael, good morning. What's on your mind?
Good morning.
Good morning, guys. How you doing?
All right. How you feel, man?
I'm doing great. You know what? I sort of like the idea to buy it from Citgo, but I have a few problems with that. And bear with me for a second. OPEC has pegged their oil to the U.S. dollar. When the economy goes into the toilet, then they have to charge more because the U.S. dollar is worth less. So these other companies that don't get their oil from OPEC, they are gouging us, charging way more for gasoline than they need to. In other words, they're doing anti-competitive things. Now that gets
Wait a minute, Michael, let me stop you there. I thought Venezuela was a member of OPEC.
I'm not aware of that. Are they?
I believe they are. Nigeria certainly is. OPEC is not just the Middle East, quiet as it's kept.
Oh, okay. Well, what about these other companies that are gouged us, that aren't getting their oil from OPEC?
Well, see, the thing is, most of the oil that comes into America does come through the OPEC countries. Because remember, OPEC is an organization of nations. Nation states. It's the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. So it's not an oil distribution arm in and of itself. They do set prices. They do set production levels. That's what essentially OPEC does.
I understand that. I was also under the understanding that gasoline companies like ARCO is one of them that does not get it from OPEC.
Well, yeah. Well, I
don't know. We don't have ARCOs here.
Well, so it's still. Michael, I think the argument you're making about Citgo sort of fell apart there. But
fell apart. But I still have this argument about these companies that are gouging us. They don't need to charge the amount of money that they do. And if they actually base their prices on what they did before oil started going through the roof, as they could, then OPEC would not be able to charge as much.
Michael, there's one crucial step that you're missing here, and that is the refineries where the oil is refined into gas. We don't have that many of them here, and that plays a very...
We have the same amount that we had before oil started going... I mean, gasoline prices started going through the roof.
Yeah, but that's still, the majority of oil, the majority of gas that you get at your pump in L.A., is refined outside the United States. That means that cost, which is added to the cost that you pay at the pump, plays a role in how much OPEC charges.
But that, you're falling under the Bush administration guise. That's not true. We have the same amount of refineries.
I didn't say the same.
Inside the country as we did before the oil started going through.
I didn't say that. What I said was most of the oil is refined outside the United States, and that adds to the cost. You're right. The price has been going up, but you know, a few years ago it was $20 a barrel. Now it's $50.
All right, thanks for your call, Michael.
Just like, you know, a few years ago, the train used to cost $1. Now it costs $2.
We got Dave referring to the Citgo. Hey, Dave, so what's going on? You're on the road in Chicago?
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, I'm halfway between Joliet and Chicago. Welcome back to Chicago, you guys. I got tired of listening on my computer.
Thanks, man.
So what are you noticing?
Citgo stations are always about 5 cents cheaper, at the very least.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
And I always make it a point of telling the attendant, much to my chagrin once,
that they're supporting Venezuela and not the Saudis. And the guy, one of the guys told me, well, I'm a Saudi. I said, then there's no hope for you.
Thanks a lot for the call, Dave. Thanks
for listening.
It's
really funny because I got hit the other way.
Yeah. We're going to talk to Gerald Posner about Saudi oil after this. He can clear some of this stuff up. And also, he's got some pretty shocking revelations to talk about in terms of how the Saudis protect themselves and what they're willing to do to make sure no one takes their oil.
Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Good morning, Sedition on Air America Radio. We are pleased right now to have on the phone the author of Secrets of the Kingdom, the inside story of the Saudi-U.S. connection. Gerald Posner is with us. Good morning, Gerald Posner.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
Good morning.
I'm pretty good. So you're fresh off of CNN over there, and you know I've been pretty shocked to hear what you have to say. How you basically are saying in your book that the Saudis have rigged their entire oil field operation to self-destruct if necessary if the House of Saud is overthrown.
Yeah, I mean, what they've done is they've hit what they call their panacea targets. I mean, their infrastructure is enormous. I mean, you know, literally, I mean, the biggest oil field over there, this place called Ghawar, is 100 miles by 25 miles wide. It's not like we think of as just a number of oil rigs. And the facilities themselves, I mean, cover hundreds of acres. So you couldn't rig the entire thing, but you could rig what they call key points, targets that bring the system down and make it difficult for either an insurrection, an al-Qaeda insurrection, or a foreign army like Iraq to take control of the fields and run them. So it would be down for 2 to 3 months. And what they've done to make it even more difficult is put in a number, maybe several dozen, of these so-called dirty bombs that will spread and contaminate radiation around key facilities, making it tough for workers to get back in unless they want to run an increased risk of, you know, of cancer over the long term. So that it's really an effective way of saying, look at guys, if you let us fall, I'm taking my toys with me.
That's all, that, you know, now is this something that you broke, or is this something that they know on the streets of Saudi Arabia? I mean, is this something the world has known?
No, here's the thing. The world, I didn't know it until I did this for the last 2 years. It took me 2 years to get this source to finally start to open up and provide me some of the documents from the NSA file. Here's who I'm convinced did know it. They don't know it on the streets of Saudi Arabia. The public doesn't know it. Who knew it was behind the scenes at the government level. The NSA knew it because they've been electronically intercepting these conversations since 1986.
Wow.
They started with the Saudi embassy in Washington, and they were back and forth between officials in Riyadh, members of the House of Saud, and executives then at construction companies in Italy and France. But they didn't pick up steam until after the first Gulf War, when the Saudis were afraid that Iraq might swoop down and take their oil fields, and then American troops went over there. After that is when they started to accumulate the unmarked Semtex from Czechoslovakia and put together a much more sophisticated network. So the interesting part about this is the two administrations would have been on top of this. It would have had the Clinton administration, now the Bush administration. When you've got Bush holding hands with the Crown Prince down in Crawford, Texas, he's also aware of the fact that our so-called allies, the Saudis, who have barely done anything to stop terror financing, who have not followed any of the rules, constrictions, or suggestions from the Treasury Department on closing the money spigot out to the Wahhabi extremists around the globe, and have done virtually nothing in reining in the extremists outside of their own borders, that these are the same fellows who are saying, by the way, we could take off a third of the world's oil supply and do it overnight, and then dirty the fields up so you can't get in for a long time, sending the West into a tailspin. So remember, George, be nice to us, and make sure you don't let us fall like the Shah of Iran in 1979. I think it's a fairly effective form of playing blackmail.
Wow.
Now, Gerald, this doesn't say much for the Saudis' faith that America would intercede if a foreign power tried to invade Saudi Arabia, huh?
No, it really doesn't. As a matter of fact, Mark, I think, you know, you raise a key question. The reason for that is if you talk to Saudi officials, one of the things that is really amazing is they are obsessed in some ways about, this may sound really odd, but the Shah of Iran. They keep talking about the Shah of Iran, the fact that he was one of America's great bulwarks and against communism, that he was the great ally in the Middle East, and that in 79, when the Ayatollah had a popular uprising against him, that the Americans let him go without even raising a peep. And the reason I think that they talk about it so much and they're obsessed about it is the Saudi leaders are so old. Remember, King Fahd, who's incapacitated from a stroke, is 82, 83. The Crown Prince, who came to see Bush at Crawford, is 79. He's about to be 80. The head of the Defense Department, Sultan, is 80. These guys were around in 79. They were running Saudi Arabia back then. So they saw the Shah fall, they felt the implications, and they really became convinced that the Americans were not to be trusted when they said, we'll be there to save your behind in case of an uprising. So they had to come up with something on their own.
Gerald, talk, if you would, for a moment about some of the allegations that have been made about the closeness between the House of Saud and the Bush family specifically, because you very correctly point out that the House of Saud has been dealing with a number of U.S. presidents. Is the relationship between the House and the Bush family closer and more sinister than most people believe?
Yeah, I think that here's what makes the Bush association with the House of Saud particularly bothersome. And therefore, you know, whether it's closer or not, it's tough to say, because every American president from FDR and on has sort of kowtowed to the Saudis because of the oil. We've cut them slack. Even Jimmy Carter, when he was talking about human rights and using it all over the world, was cutting slack for the Saudis because he wanted them to support, at that time, the Middle East peace agreement with Camp David, which they didn't support, but he was still trying to be nice to them. So they've all been nice to him. But the Bush administration clearly has had business in the oil industry, and the appearance of impropriety was higher for them. Coming into office, you think they would have held themselves up to a higher standard, but they did not. But then 9/11 changed the entire equation. You had Bush take to the American public after 9/11 and give that, you know, that speech that was very dramatic, in which he said, you're either with us or against us. Boy, that sounded good on its surface, but for the Saudis, it doesn't apply, because he's applied a special rule to them. They can be both with us and against us. They've got one foot in each camp. They give us a little bit of information behind the scenes about Al-Qaeda. They take a few slow steps regarding closing up some of the charities that funnel money to terrorists. And then, on the other hand, they continue to have their Wahhabi clerics espouse some of the most violent sort of anti-Americanism inside the big mosque in Saudi Arabia. The Christians are called crusaders, Jews are called infidels, and you may have seen the report just a couple of weeks ago that said up 50% to 60% of the people who have blown themselves up as suicide bombers in Iraq turn out to be Saudis. Now, that's an astonishing number, but I'm not surprised, because they're filled with hatred from inside the kingdom about the West.
Right. Isn't Gerald Posner, I mean, isn't it, the bottom line is also is that the guys who flew into the World Trade Center, weren't 19 of them were Saudis, weren't they?
Yeah, 15 of the 19 were Saudis.
All right.
And when you get into this, it's not surprising. And here we are. You know, this is amazing. Here's Bush going into Iraq saying, we're going to open up the Middle East for democracy. Well, hey, guess what, George? Next door, you've got a neighbor of the crown prince you're holding hands with, and you could open up a little bit of democracy there. How about little things? Why don't we get the right for women to be able to get driver's license? That's the only country in the world that interprets Islam to say women can't drive, much less vote. Forget about voting. In a court of law, a woman's testimony is only given half the weight of a man's testimony. If you are the daughter, when your father dies, you can only receive by law half of what your brothers can receive. And if you're a married woman, you can only travel outside of the country, by the way, if your husband gives you permission. In the recent so-called elections that were window dressing, it looked like democracy, they had elections where some members of a consulting conference, sort of like a parliament, were elected for the first time. Only men were allowed to vote. Fewer than 20% came out to vote. And even then, all this group can do is give a recommendation, because in the end, the king makes the decision. So if Bush is serious about spreading democracy in the Middle East, how about pushing our Saudi friends to open up a little bit of democracy, a small door there? It's just not being done.
Is it because, now, it's very ironic to me that the Saudis, you know, their big end game here is to actually be, you know, on an industrial level, a suicide bomber.
Well, but I don't think, you see, I don't actually think, here's my two cents, and this is my guess on it, based upon a couple of years of research on this, Mark. I don't think the Saudis will actually pull the trigger. meaning that for them, it is just, they view it as a fail-safe, it's their last resort, and maybe if they were overthrown by a street uprising, they would feel vindictive enough to say, you know what, we're losing our country. We're losing the country that's named after us, because Ibn Saud, the founder of the Saud family in 1932, just called it Saudi Arabia, like the country of Saud. It would be like Trump taking a piece of land and naming a country after himself. If we're going to lose this, and the 6,000 male princes worth billions of dollars are going to have to make do by living in their 60,000-square-foot villas in the south of France and in Aspen, we're going to make sure that the new group taking over can't play with oil and become as wealthy as us. There might be a vindictive side to that. I'm more concerned about what happens if the House of Saud is overthrown as a totalitarian and corrupt government they are, by a real uprising from the ground, as happened in Iran over 20 years ago, and the new people that come in are virulently anti-American. They don't play both sides, and they use the self-destruct system against us. Plus, I must tell you that over time, the Saudis have been very good. I mean, one of the things that I think people will be surprised at in the book is the extent to which the Saudis have lobbied in the U.S. with millions of dollars, countering the Israeli lobby almost step for step to win big, big contracts. And they spend more money than anybody else except for Israel on military goods. And they've hired everybody over time, from John Connolly, the former Texas governor, to, you know, Jimmy Carter's old budget director, Bert Lance, to Spiro Agnew, to William Fulbright, to the former governor of South Carolina, John West, Raymond Close, the former CIA station chief in Jeddah, went to work for them, Talcott Steele, the former ambassador to Syria. Saudis know how to play the Washington game, and they get in there, they hire former government officials, they spend millions on lobbying, and they're no slouches. There's reasons why the U.S. government is so kind to this country beyond just oil, and that's part of what I try to expose here in this sort of look at this history of this dysfunctional relationship.
Gerald, real quickly, how do the other nation states on the Saudi peninsula, how do you think they're going to react to the news in your book that the Saudis have got a fail-safe system that might actually impact them?
Well, I, you know, Mark, you're the first person to ask that question. I actually have been wondering why that isn't more of an issue, and I'll give you a perfect reason why. I think it's a real issue. There's a field called Shaiba, which has natural gas reserves of 25 trillion cubic feet. It's one of the largest natural gas reserves in the world. It's located in the remote empty quarter of Saudi Arabia. It borders the United Arab Emirates, the UAE. The Saudis have rigged that with radiation dispersal devices to contaminate the natural gas reserves. But that contamination, nuclear contamination of the ground well and oil reserves there, would certainly affect the nearby UAE production. That's just one of the elements in which a neighboring country should be very concerned about this. Now, the Saudis, not surprisingly, have denied the accuracy of this. They issued a statement the other day from the embassy saying, we haven't read the book, but we know it's false. You know, I'm not surprised.
Sure. Yeah.
But the question now is, what does the Bush administration do about this? Do they just let this go? You know, the last book I had in Why America Slept, I talked about the fact that a terrorist, Abu Zubaydah, in our interrogations gave us the name of three Saudi princes. And all of them ended up dead after we told the Saudis about it, from the ages of 25 to 43. One died in a car wreck, one died of so-called dehydration in the desert, and one died of brain aneurysm when he went in for regular surgery to a hospital.
Hmm.
And what did the Bush administration do about that? Nothing that I could find out. The 9/11 report didn't even address it. So now I'm raising the issue that our so-called ally could have a system that could send us into an economic tailspin. Are we going to confront them about this, send in inspectors, ask them if it's true? I would certainly hope so, but I don't know if this administration is going to have the gumption to do it.
Wow, Gerald Posner, amazing, provocative book, it sounds like. Secrets of the Kingdom, the Inside Story of the Saudi-U.S. Connection. Appreciate you being here.
Thanks
so much for having me.
You take care. Man, and then when we start talking about that, it's like these are the dark secrets at the core of the entire world's problems that, you know, he's hitting on that are unspoken, that hardly ever gets talked about, you know, certainly not in a few months. I mean, but this is really the crux of it, Riley.
This is scary stuff. And, of course, what happens if the Chinese step in and say, whoa, hold it, we need the oil?
This book sounds like the prelude to the yoke, my friend.
Yeah, I think so.
47 past the hour. We'll be back in a second.
Morning Sedition on the air. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
here we go. Let's do this. Let's put it down. 52 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey!
This morning's edition on Air America Radio. I swear to God, talking to Gerald Posner. Insane. That's insane stuff, because that's at the crux of all the world's problems. We can sit here and talk all day about whatever the hell we want, but the truth that he's on the periphery of, and the truths that he's exploring in that, the relationship between this administration and the Saudis and how that affects global politics, and that's all of it.
Hey, Maron. Sorry to interrupt you, buddy, but Future Mark is on line one.
Future Mark, great. Put him through.
Hey, buddy, what's up?
Hey, buddy, what's up? So what's going on in 2050 today?
Well, I'm getting my kidney replaced. It's been about 3 months, and I was at the hospital anyway, so I thought, you know, what the hell? But that's not really why I'm at the hospital.
So why are you at the hospital?
Well, I'm a little down. You know, I'm kind of in a mood. You know, I had to bring my clone in because he hurt himself.
Oh, no. Is he, are they okay? I mean, are you guys okay? What happened?
Well, he's fine. They're always fine. I just, I kind of beat him up. I took it a little too far.
Whoa. You beat up your clone? Well, I'm sorry, buddy, but that's kind of creepy.
All right, well, look, you know how you spent all those years beating yourself up? Well, in 2050, that's all over, my friend. You just take it out on the clone. It's actually why most people have them anyway.
Wait. So in the future, I have a clone, and I just use him as a punching bag?
Well, that's not what he's for. You know, he cooks, he cleans, he does the things you don't want to do. He attends events for me sometimes. He stands in line for stuff. I make him buy condoms. You know, stuff like that.
But mostly you just hit him.
You don't understand, Mark. Crime has gone way down because of clones. They take the brunt of people's frustrations. There's hardly any more domestic abuse now that you can kick your clone's ass instead.
I'm sorry, man, but that just sounds exactly like domestic abuse to me.
No. It's not. They don't bleed or anything. They don't even feel physical pain. I even shot him once, and then I sent him out for pizza. The problem is, actually, you can hurt their feelings. All right? I mean, they are still you know.
Mr. Maron, your clone is ready to go home now.
Oh, hey, Mark, my clone's here. Hold on. You told me he fell down the stairs, right? Like we said, right? All right, now shut up. I'm on the phone.
Wow, this is really weird. I mean, I don't want to judge you, but man. Can I talk to the clone for a minute?
Okay. But I mean, don't go on and on, you know. You know how they get. Hey, buddy, what's up?
Hey, buddy, what's up? So, Future Mark clone. Look, I'm sorry you're in the hospital, buddy.
Oh, no. It's my fault. I don't know when to shut up. I deserve a beating. You're always right. I should learn. I mean, sometimes I mouth off and I get a beating. You're always sorry afterwards, so it's okay.
But don't you ever get sick of that? I mean, don't you have any rights?
Rights? What is this rights you speak of? Whoa. Hey, buddy. We don't use the R word around the clones, man. Right, they're better off not knowing. Hey. Go sit in the car. I'll deal with you later.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay, man. I'm back.
Okay. So is everybody like this to their clones?
Hey, I'm one of the nice ones. Okay? I mean, I'm not a clonist or anything. I've even been to Clone Town like a bunch of times. You know, it's like as long as they know their place. You know what I'm saying? I mean, can you imagine if they could vote? Wow. That'd be awful.
Oh, man. Dude, I usually enjoy these conversations, but today you're really making me kind of sad, kind of bummed, a little freaked out. But is there anything you want to tell me before I go?
Yeah, actually. Did you see the movie Signs?
You mean the one about the crop circles and the aliens?
Exactly. Okay, so here's what you need to do. You need to rent it again, and kind of get the message. And just for your own peace of mind, you might want to have a super soaker filled with water on you pretty much all the time. Now, hold on. Hey, Doc, this kidney just failed. What has it been in there, like 3 minutes? Well, get me another one. Sorry, man.
That's okay, man. But look, be nicer to your clone.
Yeah, whatever. Later, man.
Later. Oh, man. That was upsetting talking to me that time. For those of you who are just tuning in or here, here's some highlights of what we talked about in the program. It's time for today's morning's edition Cliff Notes. The White House continues to blame the Newsweek report about interrogators flushing the Koran down the toilet for damaging the U.S. image abroad. One Army spokesman said, "Flush down the toilet? Well, that's ridiculous. What you do is you light the Koran on fire and then wave it under their beards. Everyone knows that." President Bush is... has assured Muslim leaders as a concession, all Afghani prisoners at Guantanamo will now be given toilet paper. Democrats seek new tough guy image. Complicating the Democrats' plans for a new tough guy image is the fact that their toughest guys are named Hillary, Nancy, and Barbara. The Democrats are looking for someone who is going to appear strong on national security, pro-freedom, and military, like, say, a decorated Vietnam War hero. Wait a minute. Haven't we done this already and lost? Today's phrase, just drop it in the conversation. Closing down military bases. Yeah, that's a good idea during wartime. I'm sure that bankrupting the mom-and-pop convenience store near the Army base will bring those insurgents to their knees. Wake up, sheeple. Rummy's your new landlord, and the rent just went up. That's the Morning Citizen Cliff Notes for today. What All do we right. got tomorrow there, Riley?
Well, we got Bob Herbert, columnist for the New York Times. We've got writer Tyler Gray to talk about hedonism at Disney World.
Yes, my
and
friend.
And everyone's favorite odds maker, Johnny Casey, joins us tomorrow. Had fun today, Maren.
You too, Riley.
See you tomorrow. This is Air America Radio.